Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the June 14th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week is a golf course scene. In the foreground, we have Donald Trump. He is decked out in his golfing attire. He's got kind of a somber look on his face. He's standing at the edge of a mud puddle, and he's actually covered with mud. You could see his golf ball still in the mud, like he's been trying to hit it out, and the golf club laying on the ground behind him. Looks a little frustrated. The headline is "Forever Stained: What Trump's Felony Conviction Means for the Election and for America." Not surprisingly, that story shows up several places. We'll catch it a couple of times, starting with our first main story. Republicans vow retaliation after Trump conviction. What happened? Republicans circled their wagons this week around Donald Trump and pledged to strike back against what they claimed was Democrats' weaponization of the justice system. After a Manhattan jury found Trump guilty of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records. After a six-week trial, the jurors deliberated for under 10 hours before delivering a unanimous verdict that Trump had criminally falsified records to cover up a $130,000 hush money payment to porn star Stormy Daniels in 2016. Trump, the jury found, paid off Daniels out of fear it would hurt his election prospects if Daniels revealed they'd had sex one night in 2006. Trump, who sat stone-faced as the verdict was read, blasted the trial as rigged and a scam and called Judge Juan Merchan, who will sentence him on July 11th, 4 days before the Republican National Convention, a devil. Within an hour of the decision, Trump's campaign sent out an email calling him a political prisoner. It reported raising nearly $53 million within 24 hours. Congressional Republicans rallied to Trump's defense. They hammered the trial as part of a Democratic lawfare campaign against the GOP's presumed presidential nominee, who faces dozens of criminal charges in three other cases. The trial is further evidence that Democrats will stop at nothing to silence dissent and crush their political opponents, said House Speaker Mike Johnson, who called on the Supreme Court to intervene and set this straight. House Judiciary Chair Jim Jordan demanded Democratic Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg testified about his unprecedented political prosecution of Trump, and 11 Republican senators vowed to slow passage of Democratic legislation and block President Biden's judicial and political nominees. President Biden condemned Trump's all-out assault on the justice system. It's reckless, it's dangerous, it's irresponsible for anyone to say this was rigged just because they don't like the verdict, said Biden, who called Trump a convicted felon. Trump and his allies repeatedly claimed Biden was behind the prosecution, though it was brought by a Manhattan prosecutor with no federal involvement. It's a terrible, terrible path they're leading us to, said Trump, and it's very possible that it's going to have to happen to them. What the editorial said. The historic verdict offers perhaps the starkest reminder to date of why Trump is unfit for office, said the New York Times. The bright spot in this sordid episode is that it also shows our rule of law binds everyone, even former presidents. A jury of 12 Americans examined the evidence, found proof that Trump had broken the law for political gain, and found him guilty. The jurors have delivered their verdict, Voters will give theirs in November. If the Republic is to survive, all of us, including Trump, should abide by both, regardless of the outcome. The nation might soon regret this rough turn, said the Wall Street Journal. This case was brought by an elected Democrat who campaigned as the man ready to take on Trump. Bragg concocted a legal stretch to boost falsified bookkeeping, a misdemeanor, into 34 felony counts. He got his man, but set a dangerous precedent of prosecuting political opponents. And no Democrat should cheer this result. Bragg might have opened a new destabilizing era of American politics, and no one can say how it will end. What the columnist said. Trump lost for a simple reason, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. His guilt in the Stormy Daniels election interference case was clear as day. Every Republican howling about a corrupt trial knows that Trump did just as Bragg said, that he had an affair with Daniels while his wife, Melania, was home with their newborn son, got his fixer, Michael Cohen, to pay Daniels hush money, and then reimbursed Cohen via bogus legal fees. Trump is guilty, and Republicans' anger at the justice system is an attempt to avoid grappling with this base fact. Trump is enraged not because this case was rigged, said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic, but because it wasn't. The trials he faces for far more serious federal crimes, including trying to overturn the 2020 election and stealing classified documents, have been delayed by a sustained attack on the rule of law carried out by right-wing legal activists embedded in the judiciary. Conservative Supreme Court justices and other Trump-appointed judges are punting them long enough for Trump to potentially win in November and dodge accountability forever. But in that Manhattan courtroom, Trump could not count on right-wing legal elites to skew the proceeding in his favor. The potential for an arms race of recriminations is now bottomless, said Kurt Mills in Politico. Bragg's charges had nothing to do with Trump's conduct in office, nor anything to do with his current campaign. They hinged on actions he took nearly a decade ago to conceal a tawdry one-night stand. Trump's conviction broke long-held norms, and Americans of all political stripes will one day regret ever letting this genie out of the bottle. As Republican lawmakers assail the justice system, we see a foundational rule of the Trump era in action, said David Frum in The Atlantic. To back Trump is to eventually be called to jettison every principle you ever purported to hold, including supporting law and order. If Trump is reelected, his top priority will be smashing up the American legal system to punish it for daring to hold him to account. Fellow Republicans will simply line up right behind him. The nation can have a second Trump presidency, or it contain the rule of law, but not both. The controversy of the week is on the same topic. Election 2024. Will Trump's guilty verdict matter to voters? Could last week's felony conviction cost Donald Trump the election? Sure it could, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. The conventional wisdom is that Trump is such a known commodity and voters so hardened in their partisan loyalties that his conviction on 34 counts of falsifying business records to hide an affair with a porn star won't have a major impact on the presidential race. But in a contest likely to be decided by a tiny number of votes in a handful of states, even a minor impact could tip the race to President Biden. It's early, said Nathaniel Rakich in ABCNews.com. But polls show Biden has received a small boost of about 1% since the verdict. That number could go up in coming weeks. in two post-trial polls, about 25% of independents and 10% of Republican voters said they were less likely to vote for Trump because of the guilty verdict. That's more than enough to lose Trump the election if those people vote Biden or stay home in November. Caveats abound, of course. These numbers are based on only a few polls. And less likely to doesn't mean won't. But at least for now, Trump's new status as a convicted felon does appear to be hurting him. The verdict is a game changer, but not in the way Democrats want, said Con Carroll in the Washington Examiner. More telling than the millimetric fluttering of polls is the fact that Trump's website crashed in the minutes after the blatantly political verdict, as outraged voters rushed to show their support with donations. Trump's campaign said it raised a staggering $52.8 million in the first 24 hours, much of it from small dollar donors disgusted by this complete and total witch hunt. Trump already has a playbook for this moment, said Jonathan Allen and Matt Dixon in NBCNews.com. He channeled Republican outrage over his indictment in two federal and two state cases to capture the party's nomination, and he might be able to ride the conviction backlash all the way to the White House. Not if the backlash is confined to Trump's existing supporters, said William Crystal and Andrew Egger in The Bulwark. A new poll from Data for Progress found that 38% of likely voters disapprove of the guilty verdict in his hush money trial, a number that roughly tracks with Trump's usual share of the electorate. But a majority, 56%, believe the verdict was fair, a figure that rises to 60% when you zoom in the camera on true swing voters who are genuinely undecided about their choice in November. These numbers suggest the verdict could be a major obstacle for the Trump campaign. It's not just swing voters, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. That 10% of Republicans reporting post-conviction qualms about Trump could translate to 5.7 million votes if Biden and the Democrats seize this opening. From this point on, no Democratic office holder should utter the name Donald Trump without putting the words convicted felon before it. Simply repeating that phrase won't win Biden a second term, said David Ferris in Slate. Democrats need to help voters understand what the trial revealed, that Trump is an evil, amoral cretin who had unprotected sex with an adult film star while his wife was at home caring for their newborn son. Does that mean retiring Biden's above-the-fray messaging about democracy and the rule of law? Yes, but he's trailing in the polls with only 5 months left. The time for restraint has long since passed. Here's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for duct tape. After Boeing launched two NASA astronauts to the International Space Station aboard its new Starliner capsule, despite a small helium leak in the craft's propulsion system. Fixing the leak, said Boeing's Mark Nappy, would have been quite involved. It's a good week for evolution. After British scientists found that within a minute of being fitted with an experimental robotic third thumb, 98% of test subjects were able to successfully manipulate objects with it. The extra digit, researchers said, could advance our motor capabilities beyond current biological limitations. And it was a good week for carnivores. After a specially bred super cow sold for $4 million at an auction in Brazil, a record price for any bovine. At 2,400 pounds, Viatina 19 is twice as heavy as an average adult of her breed. But it was a bad week for expectations. After a California man sued Madonna for exposing him to pornography without warning at her recent concert in Los Angeles, Justin Lipels, said he was forced to watch topless women on stage simulating sex acts, and that, adding insult to injury, Madonna was lip-syncing for most of the performance. It's a bad week for recidivism. After Pope Francis allegedly told a group of young priests in a closed-door meeting that gossip is a women's thing and that men bear a special responsibility as we wear the pants. Just days earlier, Francis had apologized for using a homophobic slur. Finally, it was a bad week for Los Angeles after the Postal Service announced that the city was number one in its annual dog bite national rankings. With 65 postal workers bitten in 2023, LA bumped Houston from the top spot. This week's briefing is titled, Here Come the Cicadas. Trillions of the noisy insects are emerging from the ground this spring and summer in a rare, synchronized event. Why so many bugs? A vast swath of the U.S. is now experiencing a natural phenomenon that occurs once every 221 years. The double emergence of two separate broods of periodical cicadas. These are not the usual annual cicadas, the mainstay of balmy summer nights, which live between 2 and 9 years and can be found worldwide. The trillions of red-eyed cacophonic insects now appearing live only in eastern North America. In the Midwest, there's brood 13, which has spent the past 17 years underground, slurping sap from tree roots, and is now crawling above ground to molt, sing, mate, and, after about 4 weeks, die. And in the south, there's brood 19, which has spent 13 years underground. 17 states stretching from Wisconsin to Louisiana and from Iowa to Maryland will be blanketed by the two broods, which made their last joint appearance in 1803. While some people may find the insects chirping annoying and their mounds of carcasses off-putting, researchers are excited. This emergence really is one of the seven biological wonders of the world, said University of Connecticut entomologist John Cooley. It's something that really nobody else in the world gets the privilege of seeing. What is a brood? It's a massive group of periodical cicadas that have timed their life cycles in unison. There are 15 broods in the U.S., each of which can contain multiple cicada species that all sing different songs. Brood 13 contains three separate species. Brood 19 has four. Scientists believe broods formed as an evolutionary survival strategy. Cicadas are slow and lack poison, a stinger, or any other defense mechanism, so simply turning out in mass means these protein-rich bugs can't be eaten into extinction by predators. Birds everywhere will feast, said University of Maryland entomologist Mike Raup, and once again the cicadas will emerge triumphant. Some researchers speculate that by appearing every 13 or 17 years, both prime numbers, the cicadas stop predators from matching their life cycles and birthing lots of young during years of abundance. But others dismiss this idea, noting that when the bugs do emerge, the world and cicada eaters have long forgotten about their existence. How do they know when to emerge? It's all to do with their diet. Cicada nymphs attach to roots and feed off of a fluid called xylem. The flow and makeup of xylem changes predictably over the year, becoming richer in amino acids as a tree buds and blossoms. We know that's what they count, said Georgetown University biologist Martha Weiss. But where they're putting their little chalk marks on the wall, we don't know. When it's time to emerge, cicada nymphs wait until the temperature 8 inches underground hits 64 degrees Fahrenheit. The nymphs then burrow to the surface, latch on to trees or plants, and shed their exoskeletons. After 4 to 6 days as pastel-colored tenoral adults, their exteriors darken and harden, and the bugs get busy seeking mates. When that happens, 1 acre of land can host more than 1 million cicadas, about 2,700 pounds worth of bugs. Do all those bugs cause damage? While cicadas are sometimes mistaken for locusts, they don't chew leaves or defoliate crops like their voracious insect cousins. Female cicadas drill slits in trees to lay their eggs, and they use a metal-enhanced shaft in their abdomen to make a hole. But this threatens only the health of very young trees and shrubs, which can be protected with netting. Any significant agricultural damage they inflict is secondary. With predators gorging themselves on cicadas, fewer caterpillars get gobbled. One study found that during the 2021 emergence of Brood 10 in parts of the Midwest, the South, and Pennsylvania, caterpillar populations doubled, and oak trees experienced a surge in leaf damage. But for the entire ecosystem, periodical cicadas are a net plus. They aerate the soil when they emerge, and their decomposing bodies infuse it with nutrients. The only real threat they pose to humans is their assault on our eardrums. Some cicadas can make a noise reaching 120 decibels at close range, about as loud as a rock concert or a passing jet. Why are they so noisy? That's how they attract mates. Males have a washboard-like structure on their abdomen called a timbal, which they strum with their legs to produce anything from the harsh screeching of Cassini cicadas to the tambourine-like shik-shik-shik of the Decula. Females respond to these fevered cries with a simple click of their wings. After mating, they lay clutches of up to 600 eggs in branches and die shortly afterward. When the eggs hatch, the infant insects drop to the ground and burrow down, waiting for their time to dig out. But scientists note that this multi-year cycle seems to be shifting, with periodical cicadas now emerging 10 to 14 days earlier than they did on average in 1940, and more stragglers surfacing without their brood. What's behind this change? Researchers suspect global warming is messing with bugs' time-counting mechanism. An unusually warm winter can cause trees to leaf early, which cicadas count as a year. If a cold spell causes trees to pause this process, then resume when spring arrives for real, the insects will count a second year. Some entomologists suspect warming temperatures could shift 17-year cicadas to a 13-year cycle and 13-year cicadas to a 9-year cycle. But many worry that climate change is happening so fast that species won't be able to evolve adaptations to keep up with it. Cicadas are going to be handicapped in a very real sense by their long life cycle, said John Lill, a biologist at George Washington University. You can only evolve as fast as you can have new generations. And then some of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. We'll start with protecting the NRA's speech rights. No matter how much you dislike the National Rifle Association, said Billy Binion, Its resounding Supreme Court victory last week is indisputably good for free speech. In a 9-0 decision, the Supreme Court found a New York State official had infringed on the NRA's free speech rights. In 2018, Maria Bulo, who then led New York's State Department of Financial Services, allegedly warned banks and insurers that she would more stringently enforce regulations on those that did business with the NRA. She and then Governor Andrew Cuomo jointly urged companies to sever relations with the gun group. This, all nine justices agreed, clearly crossed the line from persuasion into coercion. Rightly so. It would be hard to find a more obvious violation of the Constitution than the weaponization of government power to cripple advocacy disfavored by the state. The NRA's relentless opposition to all gun laws makes it one of the more polarizing lobbying organizations in the country. But the First Amendment protects the speech of groups or individuals others find repugnant. That's why the American Civil Liberties Union chose to represent the NRA. Even in our polarized age, some things, like the First Amendment, really aren't partisan. A cynical calculation by billionaires. For the billionaire donor class, this election is about one thing, said Timothy Noah, keeping rich people's taxes low. Wall Street billionaires like J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, Blackstone Group CEO Steven Schwarzman, and investor Nelson Peltz condemned Donald Trump after the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, while hedge fund manager Kenneth Griffin called the former president a three-time loser after the 2022 midterms. Yet all four sing a different tune today. They claim to support Trump because of inflation, which has dropped to 3.4%, the immigration crisis, or rising anti-Semitism on the left. But they're all full of it. These plutocrats are actually drifting back to Trump because they want to keep the tax cuts he gave them in 2017, which are due to expire in December 2025. President Biden plans to let the cuts for the wealthy and corporations run out, keeping them only for Americans earning under $400,000. Trump's plan to extend them would increase the budget deficit by $4 trillion over a decade, which, along with his promised steep tariffs, would be highly inflationary. Nonetheless, they're holding their noses and rallying around Trump simply because he'll make them richer. This column comes from France. Forcing people to choose death. The debate around the right to die in France has become unhinged, said Damien Leguay. The administration of President Emmanuel Macron introduced legislation in March that would allow terminally ill patients to end their lives under certain conditions. It was a limited, humane proposal, but now overzealous lawmakers are stretching it beyond recognition. Scrapping strict criteria like terminal illness and end of life, the new language would extend euthanasia to those with any incurable condition in an advanced stage. Many cancers and neurodegenerative diseases are incurable, as are some mental illnesses. Should we, as a compassionate society, really be offering assisted suicide to a 19-year-old woman petrified by a cancer diagnosis when treatment could extend her life by years? Most frightening is a new provision making it a crime to obstruct assisted dying, which could send to jail anyone who hinders the death of a qualifying patient. What about informing them of other options? Is it hindering to grab someone who's about to throw themselves off a bridge? Assisted death without limits can easily slip into inhumane disregard for sick people who may feel pressured in their lives rather than accept the palliative care they deserve. And the last word, our feature article, a too perfect stone. Lab-grown diamonds are indistinguishable from mined ones and much cheaper, said Amanda Mull in The Atlantic. For many brides-to-be, that's a problem. Last year, a funny thing happened at Ring Concierge's Manhattan showroom. A bride-to-be brought her engagement ring back to the popular jewelry store after wearing it for a few weeks and wanted to trade out her diamond for a worse one. The woman was worried that the original rock was too clear, too bright, too perfect for its large size. Ring Concierge's CEO, Nicole Wegman, told me, she wanted to replace it with a lower quality stone of a similar size, something a little less bright white. Brides sometimes bring in new rings for tweaks. Maybe they want the fit adjusted, or they're having second thoughts about the setting. Occasionally, they decide they want to pay extra money to go bigger. That the central diamond is too good, however, is just not a complaint that jewelers get, except in cases of totally blown budgets. But this particular bride wasn't worried that she'd spent too much money, Wegman said. In a sense, the bride was worried that she hadn't spent enough. She and her fiancé had selected a lab-grown diamond, a gem that's chemically identical to a mined diamond at a fraction of the cost, in order to get the kind of size and clarity that would push a natural stone far beyond their means. Now, she was concerned that everyone they knew would take one look at the big perfect stone on her finger and immediately see the trade-off. In recent years, lab-grown diamonds have flooded into the market, causing something of an existential crisis in the natural diamond industry, which has spent decades making the diamond engagement ring into a singular Goliath of American luxury shopping. This new wave of stones offers a tempting bargain. You can add the ring of your dreams or something much closer to it, even if your budget is significantly smaller than the average ring cost of somewhere around $5,500. A real stone and its symbolic value in life and romance no longer requires all that expense or all of the baggage of mined stones' bloody imperial history. Diamonds, it would seem, are now a solved problem. Except, of course, a diamond's appeal has never had that much to do with the chemical specifications or atomic structure of the stone itself. Even as lab diamond sales have taken off, Wegman told me, most buyers have the same approach as that regretful bride. They want to stick a stone that would seem plausible for their income and status were it mined, and they don't plan to tell their family and friends that it's not. The rationality of lab-grown diamonds is butting up against an even greater force, the cultural power of their mined counterparts. Built on generations-long influence campaign to change the way Americans think about marking personal milestones. In the end, it's a fight that lab diamond purveyors might not want to win. Diamonds, as you have probably heard before, perhaps from someone trying to get out of buying one, are just chunks of carbon. More precisely, they are chunks of carbon that form more than 100 kilometers below ground, some of which are eventually carried by volcanic activity back toward the surface, where they can be reached by miners. Natural diamonds are generally pit mined, a difficult, dangerous process in which they are hauled by humans out of great human-made craters in the earth, and they can develop in only a handful of rock varieties. For generations, De Beers, a British South African mining company that the journalist Edward J. Epstein described in a now legendary 1982 Atlantic expose on the industry as the most successful cartel arrangement in the annals of modern commerce, controlled enough of the trade to meter the supply of jewelry quality stones released to the consumer market, ensuring a sense of scarcity and high stable prices. Over the past few decades, however, De Beers' influence has waned. Lab diamonds promised beautiful stones created with industrial predictability and control. The first lab diamonds were produced in the 1950s, but decades of additional research were needed to refine a commercially viable process that can consistently produce customizable, gem-quality diamonds. Now what takes nature perhaps a billion years and a great deal of happenstance can be accomplished in a factory in a few weeks with the right machinery, the right materials, including a sliver of diamond that acts as a seed, and enough skilled technicians. A 1-carat round mined diamond, the kind that anchors a huge proportion of American engagement rings, currently costs anywhere from $50 to $1,000 to produce in its rough form, depending on where it's mined, according to Idan Golan, a diamond industry analyst and managing partner at the jewelry analytics firm Tenoris. In a lab setting, that same diamond now costs $15 to $20 to manufacture. At retail, a lab-grown diamond will generally sell to a consumer for less, and sometimes much less, than half of what a mined stone with near-identical characteristics sells for. Even the Gemological Institute of America, GIA, a highly influential industry organization that provides, among other things, widely accepted standards of diamond grading that help determine a stone's worth, has stopped referring to lab-grown diamonds as synthetic. They're real, no caveats. You don't have to be especially skilled at math to discern the grave disruption that this confluence of circumstances could cause for traditional diamond industry. Russell Shore, a veteran of the diamond industry who spent almost 2 decades as the senior market analyst for GIA, told me that according to some of the estimates he's seen, lab diamonds accounted for 30 to 40% of the engagement ring stones sold in the United States last year. Overall, the numbers are impressive. In 2016, about $1 billion worth of lab diamonds was sold worldwide. By 2022, the total was $12 billion, or about 17% of the global diamond market, according to Golan. Diamond growers aren't just competing against purveyors of mined gems. They're competing against one another for dominance of a market that is not yet mature. This competition is rapidly driving down prices as the sales numbers shoot up. New players can buy a few machines, lease some factory space in a country with cheap labor, and start churning out low-quality lab-grown gemstones in short order. Like natural diamonds, lab-grown stones can have occlusions or wonky colors, and those grown too quickly develop what can only be described as stretch marks. What has happened is exactly what you'd expect when supply far, far exceeds demand. According to Golan's data, at the end of 2018, the average wholesale price for a 1-carat round lab diamond was $1,786. At the end of 2023, it was $163. It's a race to the bottom, Shore said. Retail prices have not collapsed quite as quickly, but they too are trending down in rather dramatic fashion. On one level, that's great. Diamonds have endured as a part of engagement jewelry for lots of reasons that have little to do with practicality. But the stone's characteristics, chiefly their incredible durability and neutral color, do make them a reasonable choice, in purely physical terms, for jewelry you intend to wear on your hand every day for decades. If big, flawless diamonds are no longer even plausibly rare or difficult to source, then people who want a diamond of any sort can simply choose the size and shape that suits them best and not worry about their budget, or about what their diamond says about their position within old-fashioned ideas of status and hierarchy. Except, well, what if all of that is still sort of the point? Lots of people want to give or receive big diamonds because of their implications, not in spite of them. Wegman, Ring Concierge's CEO, was skeptical of the idea that price had become incidental to the appeal of a diamond engagement ring. Lab diamond prices will have to bottom out at some point, but if they go too low, then is it not going to be enough for an engagement ring, she asked. The idea that receiving a big, beautiful diamond engagement ring might be less exciting if that ring doesn't strain your beloved's budget is, of course, a boon to those in the business of selling jewelry, no matter what kinds of diamonds are in their inventory. A decades-long media campaign funded by the De Beers cartel didn't just ensconce diamond rings as the default symbol of the American betrothal. In order to goose sales of larger diamonds, it also painted the stone size as a shorthand for a couple's personal and professional success. The expense itself has always been what makes the ring meaningful. Why anyone would long to spend extra money when far more affordable, identically useful options abound can be a maddening question, but only when asked about products you're not personally interested in. You may not feel that way about diamonds, but maybe sports cars or designer handbags or rare whiskeys do it for you. These are all known as Veblen goods, so named after the American economist Thorstein Veblen, who first described the phenomenon in 1899. Veblen goods are products for which demand increases as their price goes up. People come up with all kinds of arguments for why any particular Veblen good is totally worth the money in rational terms, fine craftsmanship, superior materials, that sort of thing. Sometimes these assertions are true enough, but they're not complete. A Veblen good's primary utility is for social signaling. It derives value from its price instead of the other way around. It's desirable because people with less money can't have it. All of this puts lab diamond purveyors in an awkward position. If lab diamonds become too cheap, they can ruin the demand for diamonds altogether. Lab diamond makers tend to argue that their product is also more ethical and sustainable, attributes constantly said to be of incredible importance to the young people who make up most of the engagement ring market. And to be fair, diamond mining historically has earned its reputation for cruelty and excess, even if the modern industry has made efforts to clean up the worst offenses of its generations past. But public proof of lab growers' sustainability claims can be thin on the ground, and no clear evidence exists that many diamond shoppers are excited enough about an environmentally friendly sales pitch to switch their preference. If price isn't already a concern, no matter how anyone ignores or sanitizes it, part of the appeal of luxury goods is the difficulty or danger involved in service of the buyer's pleasure. Lab diamonds are just as sparkly and beautiful as their mined counterparts, but they aren't a product that has much clear value if people aren't still being driven mad by desire for the mined diamonds they currently seek to undercut. Counterintuitive though it may seem, that's great news for the traditional diamond trade. Lab stones' explosive popularity might actually strengthen demand for at least some types of mined diamonds, rather than subvert it. You can already see that beginning to happen in the numbers. If you look carefully, the size of the average American natural diamond engagement ring, Golan said, has begun to creep up in the past few years. It used to be about a carat, and now it's up to 1.2 or 1.3, a phenomenon that he attributed to the proliferation of big lab-grown stones, which make smaller natural diamonds look extra small in comparison, thereby encouraging those buyers to expand their budget to keep up. Buyers could also enter the market for fine jewelry at a younger age and lower price point with lab diamonds, and then upgrade to natural stones as they get older, get engaged, and make more money. Something Shore said he also expected to see as owners of lab engagement rings grow older. Upgrading your diamond and expanding your collection along with your socioeconomic status, after all, has long been a part of the diamond invention. At Ring Concierge, Wegman has so far been reluctant to expand lab diamonds outside of the engagement ring business. But as time goes on, she said, customers have begun to ask for lab options in other styles, even those who want a mined diamond for their engagement ring. The two types of products are beginning to look more complementary than competitive. This past Black Friday, Ring Concierge dipped its toe into those waters for the first time, offering a pair of lab diamond stud earrings, a style that Wegman said is a financial stretch for almost everyone when using mined diamonds, but it requires two big stones. The earrings were a hit. A version of this story originally appeared in The Atlantic. One of the obituaries, the basketball giant who beat pain and a stutter. Bill Walton, 1952 to 2024. Bill Walton was one of the greatest centers in basketball history, leading UCLA to two national titles before landing NBA championships for the Portland Trail Blazers and the Boston Celtics. But he didn't stop there. After retiring from the court, he overcame a stutter to launch a second career as an eccentric and often hilarious broadcast commentator, holding forth on the game's intricacies with leaps into history, politics, and the glories of his beloved Grateful Dead. "I was incredibly shy and never said a word," he once said. "Then when I was 28, I learned how to speak. It's become my greatest accomplishment of my life and everybody else's biggest nightmare." William Theodore Walton III was born in La Mesa, California, said the New York Times, to a social worker father and a librarian mother. One day, the family next door dismantled its backboard and basket, and he and his father reassembled it at their house. Walton had found his passion. After a stellar high school career, he landed at UCLA, where he won his first NCAA title in 1972, the same year that he was arrested at a protest against the Vietnam War. His most famous game came in the next year's final, said ESPN.com, in which he shot an incredible 21 for 22 from the field and led the Bruins to another national championship. The 6'11" Walton quickly became a dominant force in the NBA, driving the Trail Blazers in 1977 to their only NBA championship. His 14-year career was disrupted by chronic foot injuries and dozens of painful surgeries, and he played just 468 out of 1,148 regular season games. In 1988, when his injuries had progressed to the point where he could no longer run, he retired and took up broadcasting, calling games for NBC, ESPN, and CBS with goofy glee. Walton brought a sense of wonder joy and wackiness to his on-air coverage, said CNN.com. He showed off his tie-dyes, showered colleagues with gifts, and once gobbled a cupcake, lit candle and all. But constantly cramming his huge frame into airplane seats took a toll, and his spine collapsed in 2007. Spinal fusion surgery finally took away his chronic pain and restored his ability to walk. My life has been defined by meteoric rises and climbs to the top, and then these catastrophic health challenges that would just take me down, he said in 2016. I never thought that I'd be free of pain. I am the luckiest guy on earth. And over on the Talking Points page, baseball seeking to rectify its record books. Josh Gibson was the greatest hitter in Negro League history, said Gene Seymour in CNN.com. And now, 77 years after his death, the slugging catcher finally gets a chance to become a household name. Gibson became baseball's all-time batting champion last week after Major League Baseball sought to correct what it called a long-time oversight by incorporating Negro League statistics into its official record books. Dubbed the Black Babe Ruth, Gibson compiled a lifetime average of .372 while playing for the Homestead Grays and other teams in the racially segregated 1930s and 40s, placing him ahead of Ty Cobb's .367 average. For the past 3 years, a 17-member panel vetted thousands of Negro League box scores to compile the new data for MLB's revered record books. Belatedly, baseball is now seeking to give proper recognition to legendary black players such as Gibson, Satchel Paige, Buck Leonard, and Cool Papa Bell, whose achievements were unfairly excluded. If there's an article of faith that the Church of Baseball holds more dearly than any other, it's fairness. Yes, these were great players, said Michael Stirk in Barstool Sports, but we can only hypothesize what their stats would have been had baseball not been segregated. It's absurd to create an artificial new world in which black players were not excluded. The simple truth is that the two leagues were not equivalent, said Colin Fleming in the Baltimore Sun. Negro League seasons were much shorter, and the average level of competition was not the same. Gibson had just 838 verified lifetime hits, compared with 4,191 for Cobb, and is now credited for the highest single-season batting average of .466 in just 157 at-bats in 1945. No one hits .466 except a kid in the Little League. Negro League statistics don't need any asterisk, said Kevin B. Blackstone in the Washington Post, unless you want to put an asterisk on all baseball records. All of them, Babe Ruth's home runs, Ty Cobb's hits, Walter Johnson's strikeouts, took place in their own racial vacuum. White players who never had to face the pitching of Paige or the slugging of Gibson in their primes should face the same skepticism as black stars of that era. The Negro Leagues were never less than major, and the whites' only major leagues were not as major as we've mythologized them to be. And a few of the shorter notes. The Republican National Committee and other GOP-linked groups have already filed dozens of lawsuits in 25 states related to the November election. Some seek to prevent states from counting mail-in ballots that are missing a date. Others challenge the accuracy of states' voter registration lists. Excessive heat was listed as a factor on the death certificates of more than 2,300 people last year, the highest number in 45 years of records. Public health experts say that figure is a fraction of the real death toll. Last summer was the hottest on record. A third of the deaths occurred in Arizona, which endured 73 days with temperatures above 100 degrees. To protect against attacks by Ukrainian drones, the Russian military has begun deploying its so-called turtle tanks to the battlefield. Armored vehicles retrofitted with shell-like casings made of corrugated metal. The extra armor can deflect some drone strikes, but also slows the tank and stops the vehicle from rotating its turret. On the poll watch, globally, 17% of Generation Z, born between 1996 and 2012, identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, non-binary, or gender fluid, compared with 11% of millennials, 1980 to 1995, 6% of Generation X, 1966 to 1979, and 5% of baby boomers, 1945 to 1965. And we'll close out today with a quote from Cher, quoted in Time. She says, "All of us invent ourselves. Some of us just have more imagination than others." And with that, we have once again run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.